Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, a weekly think tank on how to take back our cities, farmland, and water, our money, production, and trade, our media, education, and culture, our religion, and even our God. Our goal is global community sovereignty, that every community in the world be able to use their own resources to feed and nurture their own children. This is the scale on which we weigh economics, scriptures, institutions, policies, and justice. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz and Upstart Radio Online. Welcome to the 13th episode of Third Paradigm. We'll begin with an idea to make money off our illegal immigrants instead of spending millions rounding them up. Then we'll send a Valentine note to Firestone Cares from Teresa Cares. Firestone Cares is the public relations arm of Japanese-owned Bridgestone Firestone. During the recent Super Bowl, they sponsored the halftime show. This multi-million-dollar extravaganza was in turn sponsored by Liberian rubber tappers who make $3.35 a day tapping 700 trees. For the first time, these workers have a union, but activists say Firestone hasn't kept its promises. And Firestone says they're discouraged that some people just don't appreciate all that they've done. So we'll send a little token of our esteem. We'll end with a recap of my experience at the Michael Parenti speaking event this week. This includes my title story on Josephus and the Multicolored Turncoat. But first, we'll start with a poem by Mary Oliver that continues my crusade for the custodial staff. It's called Singapore. In Singapore, in the airport, a darkness was ripped from my eyes. In the women's restroom, one compartment stood open. A woman knelt there, washing something in the white bowl. Disgust argued in my stomach, and I felt in my pocket for my ticket. A poem should always have birds in it. Kingfishers, say, with their bold eyes and gaudy wings. Rivers are pleasant, and of course trees. A waterfall, or if that's not possible, a fountain rising and falling. A person wants to stand in a happy place. In a poem. When the woman turned, I could not answer her face. Her beauty and her embarrassment struggled together, and neither could win. She smiled and I smiled. What kind of nonsense is this? Everybody needs a job. Yes, a person wants to stand in a happy place in a poem. But first, we must watch her as she stares down at her labor, which is dull enough. She is watching the tops of the airport ashtrays, as big as hubcaps with a blue rag. Her small hands turn the metal, scrubbing and rinsing. She does not work slowly nor quickly like a river. Her dark hair is like the wing of a bird. I don't doubt for a moment that she loves her life. And I want to rise up from the crust and the slop and fly down to the river. This probably won't happen, but maybe it will. If the world were only pain and logic, who would want it? Of course it isn't. Neither do I mean anything miraculous, but only the light that can shine out of a life. I mean the way she unfolded and refolded the blue cloth, the way her smile was only for my sake. I mean the way this poem is filled with trees and birds. That was Singapore by Mary Oliver from her collection called House of Light. The music is Arlanda from Julia Kent's CD named Delay. The CD cover has bleary photos of 3 a.m. clocks and empty airport terminals. It intersperses her haunting cello compositions with incomprehensible echoing announcements, which was perfect for the purpose of this poem. If the beautiful face above the porcelain bowl had been in the U.S., she might have been one of the 96,000 people rounded up by immigration raids over the last 5 years at a taxpayer cost of $625 million. These raids, called by cute names like Operation Return to Sender, were mandated by Congress that their arrests include at least 75% criminal suspects with deportation orders. But in 2006, an internal memo upped the quota of total arrest and abolished the criterion. So they went after easier targets, namely workers and parents. The percent with criminal charges dropped to 9. Now these are 91% model non-citizens. I know of deportations here where the 19-year-old daughter was left with younger siblings and the house cleaning business. As responsible as my daughters are, I can't imagine them doing the same. So I have an alternative proposal on how to apply that $625 million over the next 5 years. Let's hire them to teach our kids to take over when all the illegal immigrants leave. While our kids trash the house, their kids are cleaning them for other people. While ours want money to buy things, theirs make money to pay the bills. While ours snap at their siblings, theirs are cooking, helping with homework, nursing through illnesses. While ours can't take care of themselves, theirs are providing elder care to the homebound and daycare to toddlers and infants. I know parents who are spending fortunes sending their kids to wilderness boot camps, where their survival depends on learning responsibility. How different is this from being an illegal immigrant? I'll bet immigrants would take on our wayward kids for less, especially if they don't speak English and don't have to listen to them whine. Hell, we could probably make back that $625 million from frustrated parents whose kids have no concept of reciprocity. We'll buy some farms miles away from civilization and let them live in the real world where you only get what you produce. By the time they come back, the rest of us will be in the same boat anyway, between the dropping value of the dollar and growing solidarity in Latin America. Sooner rather than later, Mexico will kick out parasitic U.S. corporations and claim back its hardworking citizens. At that point, we'll have the only kids on the block who know how to slaughter a chicken and pound maize. Viva the revolution! A place still reeling from violent devolution is Liberia. By the time you hear this on Monday, the judges at The Hague may have returned their verdict on Charles Taylor, who recruited child soldiers into his brutal rebel force. The website charlestaylortrial.org posts the transcripts daily. I only read the last witness, who was a father whose house was burned by the rebels. He managed to put it out, but they came back the next day and burnt it again. This time they cut off his left hand with a machete, at which his son cried. The rebels threatened to do the same to the son if he didn't stop, but the father said he'd rather they cut off his other hand, and so they did. In this traumatized and truncated Liberia, the Firestone rubber plantation positions itself as a haven of stability. It has 7,000 workers, if you don't count the 16,000 children. However, each rubber tapper has a quota of 700 trees per day, with half tapped twice, or their wages of $3.35 are cut in half. This is impossible for one person to do alone, and so their children work before the foremen wake up. Firestone opposes child labor by threatening to fire the parents, but to truly end it, they have to change the quota system. This has been the chief demand of FAWUL, the first democratically elected union in their 80-year history. But a year later, Firestone still hasn't changed. When advocates used the high-profile Super Bowl to ask why, we received an email back from the PR department called Firestone Cares. It stated their steadfast commitment to the people of Liberia after the Civil War. They point to their reopened hospital and 1,300 rebuilt homes. They've started an implantation shuttle and built a multi-million-dollar water treatment facility. Wastewater from rubber production no longer flows into the Farmington River, but moves into wetlands for natural, biological treatment. They are disheartened that some people ignore the improvements they've made and urge everyone to visit before they judge. When a member of the Stop Firestone Coalition did visit, her first action was to vomit from the stench. But there are better reasons to vomit, like uninvestigated allegations that Firestone used their shipping channel to bring in the weapons. Why did Firestone harbor Charles Taylor on the plantation? Why did they hire Adolphus Dolo as their head of security? In 1996, Adolphus Dolo used the diplomatically immune Mamba Point to rain rocket-fired grenades on Monrovia and to loot humanitarian agencies, including the theft of 489 UN vehicles and cassocks and communion wine from the Archbishop. The only untouched compounds were the U.S. Embassy and the Mamba Hotel. Like Nero, Dolo dined while Monrovia burned. In a horrific scene, the author ventured onto Michelin Street, where he saw the burnt bodies of those killed by forcing their heads through flaming automotive tires. Don't tell me Firestone cares, or about your commitment to the Liberian people. It's enough to make me vomit. But this is Valentine's Day week. On a cheerier note, we'll break for a song my youngest daughter wrote about child labor on cocoa plantations.
Don't wait, activate, make the world start spinning in a different direction. Don't wait, activate, open up your arms and let your wings take flight. Don't wait, activate, a small world after all needs your protection. Don't wait, activate, cause other kids at night can't see the light. They named the coast for ivory and not the elephant. It's all about what's bought and sold and not the life that's spent. They brought me here at 6 years old to pick the cocoa bean. It's too much to think of home for years I haven't seen. I ran away but I got caught. As punishment they cut my feet. I had to walk while my feet healed with every step they bleed. Oh, where's my mother? Where's my father? Where's someone who cares for me? What's meant to be?
shown. Don't wait, activate. Open up your arms and let your wings take flight. Don't wait, activate. A small world after all needs your protection. Don't wait, activate. 'Cause other kids at night can't see the light. They lock us in a room to sleep together on the ground. I listen to the rain until it doesn't make a sound. One by one the stars slip by, a hole too high to climb. I name each star and make a wish to see another time. The time when children play and learn, when no one's left to cry alone, when no one's body, no one's soul, and no one's far from home. A time when prophets bought with the lives of something no one understands. A time when all kids make the change for good that's in our hands. Spinning in a different direction. Don't wait, activate. Open up your arms and let your wings take flight. Don't wait, activate. A small world after all needs your protection. Don't wait, activate. 'Cause other kids at night can't see the light.
That was Don't Wait, Activate. The chorus was written by my daughter Cassandra when she was 8. A postcard had come in the mail to activate a credit card, and she says now she only wanted to distract me from making her do math. I wrote the lyrics using testimonies from a lawsuit brought on behalf of the child slaves. John Buckelman, a butcher at New Leaf Market, performed and wrote the music. John is now teaching English and welcomes anyone who wants to take this song and run with it. This week, my middle daughter, Olivia, had an assignment to ask me for 2 life lessons. My first was, if you don't succeed at first, aim higher. My second was, sometimes the person you least expect turns out to be the most significant. This was my experience at the Michael Parenti fundraiser, sponsored by Free Radio Santa Cruz. Michael's writing has made a big impact on me. And so, for the last 4 weeks, I've been coordinating a fundraising dinner along with his speaking event. I hope this would give people, including myself, more chance to talk with him. At the event, I was to introduce him, and so read 3 books and some articles to prepare my speech. Among these books, I was especially intrigued by The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which gives a people's history of the 1st century B.C., My own research has been on the other 1st century, AD, or Common Era as it's now known to scholars. To put it bluntly, I think that the Bible is a 2-part propaganda piece, crafted after the empire's reconquest of Jerusalem in 76. I think that every story in it, including the life of Jesus, is allegory and not history, made up by those who collaborated in the re-enslavement of their own people. To whitewash their role as traitors, I think they took popular accounts of the revolution's heroes, well known at the time, and changed the name to demonize the innocent and deify the guilty. Chief among the inventors of this twisted mythology was Josephus, adopted son of Caesar, which makes him a son of God on his father's side. Curiously, Josephus's father, Matthias, was born during the census that the Bible uses to date the birth of Jesus. The first recorded gospel is also Matthew, or Matthias. Like Jesus, Matthias's father was Josephus, or Joseph. Like other wealthy Hebrews, they may have traveled to Egypt to avoid the census tax. Genealogies don't record the names of women, but Josephus traced his priestly lineage through his mother. The name Mariamne was common among this high-born tetrarchy. The name Mary, however, was Roman slang for a rebellious woman, along with its derivatives, Martha and Molly, which is still used in the term gun mole. This makes sense when you look at Mar as the Latin word for sea. No seafaring people would call the sea obedient. But Matthias's mother, although a Mary as an unwitting member of the Hebrew Revolution, was obedient to Rome and therefore virginal and not consorting with the insurgents. The story of Jesus instructing teachers at the temple is straight out of Josephus's own autobiography. Josephus spent 4 years in the desert as a youth, studying the three schools of Hebrew thought, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. The fourth philosophy, however, was developed by Judas Sicariot, which means assassin. He was named for the public knifings of traitors and collaborators that his sect practiced. Josephus saw this school as the devil's workshop. Although they defended the right of armed insurgency against the oppressor, they intermarried and lived peacefully with other Hebrew sects, like the Samaritans, and with Canaanites, such as the Edomites and the Sodomites. In solidarity with the Idumeans and Egyptians, they fought for their freedom along with other colonized peoples. Josephus turned against the revolution after he was captured by Rome. But how did he, as a member of the upper class, become a resistance leader in the first place? If they were killing collaborators, it seems like the family of Josephus would be high on the list. What kind of man was his father, Matthias? Perhaps his father was like Julius Caesar in Parenti's history, someone who used his privilege to stand up for the rights of all. Maybe, although he was highborn, he ended up being crucified under Pontius Pilate as a rebel, either mistakenly or as a lesson to other sympathetic elites. Either action would have been in character for Pilate, who was so infamous for executions without trial that he was recalled by Rome. But if Matthias, hypothetically, was taken down from a peasant's cross, he would have been buried in the crypt of his wealthy forefathers, Joseph Arimathea. Era, like Bar, meaning son of, and Matthias and Josephus being the alternating names of his patriarchal lineage. Of course, the devil's in the details, and I wouldn't expect Parenti to just take my word for it. So where do you start to turn upside down everything we think we know about the Bible? Since Parenti had studied Greek, I sent him my paper analyzing the Greek word listes, which means rebel in Josephus, but is translated as robber in the New Testament. In example, the den of thieves, arrested in the night like a common thief, and of course, the good thief and the bad thief. Using this corrected translation of robber as rebel, I show that Jesus denies 3 times that he's one of the insurgents. Even on the cross, the good thief, or the repentant revolutionary, says, "Leave this guy alone. We deserve what we got, but he's innocent. He was never one of us." So what is Jesus innocent of, according to the good thief? Well, revolution against the empire. And how does Jesus respond to that? Does he say, "No one deserves to be tortured," or "All people deserve to be free"? There's no reason for him to be coy. What more are the Romans going to do to him? But no, his answer is, "Thanks, buddy. You'll be with me tonight in the kingdom of heaven. I appreciate you clearing my name." This is not the statement of a people's Messiah. This is the statement of an imperialist. In the lead-up to meeting Parenti, I exchanged emails with him about logistics. In the midst of these, I dropped a few lines about my research and attached the paper. The night of the dinner, I bided my time. Many people wanted to talk with him, including a 93-year-old woman seated next to him so she could hear. But when I found an appropriate lull, I asked him what he thought about my ideas. "We're not going to talk about it," he said. "It's a ridiculous theory." "What, you think there was some kind of conspiracy? People see conspiracies everywhere. You'd need a mountain of evidence to prove it. And even if it were true, what does it matter?" He hadn't read the paper, and after a few feeble responses on my part, it was obvious that it was going nowhere. When I got to the event, somewhat deflated, I was reading over my intro when the daughter of the 93-year-old came up to me. "My mother says you're brilliant," she said. "She told me that every time Parenti dismissed you, you came back with more research and facts." "I think that woman knew more about it than he did," she said. I told her that her mother had made my night and enabled me to get up and give my intro without a qualm. So sometimes the person you least expect turns out to be the one you need, and sometimes the person who's hard of hearing is the one who really listens. This song, Vindicated by Dashboard Confessional, goes out to my new friend Bert and her daughter Phyllis. I hope that at 93, I'm still eating Sri Lankan food with gusto and am receptive to new ideas that overturn everything I thought I knew. This has been Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm. Thanks to Skidmark Bob for production and editing.
Spinning redemption, winding in and winding out. The shine of it has caught my eye and roped me in so mesmerizing, so hypnotizing. I am captivated, I am
vindicated.
Dangles on a string, like slow spinning redemption.